Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Lewis. A Newport News woman is taking her fight over redistricting to the Supreme Court. We'll talk with her today, and we'll also consider the work of a Virginia organization that's trying to bring about nonpartisan redistricting. That would be a huge change from the way things are done now. And the Virginia Board of Health handed down an important decision yesterday about requirements for abortion clinics. We'll have the details. Let's talk about it after this news from NPR. Good Tuesday afternoon. We're glad to have you with us today. It's an exciting day to be in Hampton Roads tonight at the Norfolk Forum, 2 weeks before Election Day, which, again, 2 weeks from today, we all go to the polls. 2 weeks from today is the day. But tonight at the Norfolk Forum, James Carville and Tucker Carlson will be the guest speakers, and I feel very confident it will be a genteel conversation. Where voices will be soft and points will be made. So that'll be fun tonight. I'm looking forward to that at the Norfolk Forum. Hope you have your tickets. I think there may still be some individual tickets available if you would like to check that out. Check out the Norfolk Forum's website. I believe there are a few individual tickets still available, but it'll be a big old fun time tonight. Very happy to be last night with the Center for the Study of Religious Freedom at Virginia Wesleyan College. We had a very interesting discussion on leadership and religion, and what different religious faiths say about the role of leaders and how that takes shape in the context of the election coming up in 2 weeks. So it was a very, very interesting conversation. Really enjoyed it. I'll have some thoughts about that on Thursday's show, but I have to just say it did sort of make me feel better about everything. So, you know, there are a lot of us who are looking at this election thinking, wow, November 8th is going to be a very interesting day, and what happens on November 9th? So that was a piece of our conversation last night. It was very, very interesting. So I have some thoughts about that just a little bit later this week. In the second half of our program today, we're going to be talking with Lois Shepherd. She's a professor of biomedical ethics at the University of Virginia, and she's going to be talking with us about this new ruling that was handed down yesterday by the Board of Health in Virginia with regard to abortion clinics and what kinds of requirements they need to have in terms of their physical plant operations. So we'll talk with her a little bit later about that. First, though, we are talking about redistricting. And as you know, that is a subject that has been very much on the minds of our listeners for many, many, many years. The fact of the matter is we have talked a lot about it on this broadcast and its impact on voting. So to put it very, very simply, and probably too simply, the party in power typically creates the districts and often tries to organize them to their advantage. And at issue is what some believe is an effort to stack the deck by packing minorities into one or two districts, which presumably reduces their influence in neighboring districts. And there are two cases around this issue being heard at the Supreme Court in December. And one is being brought by a local woman. So we'll talk with her in the course of our conversation. But we also want to bring to you, to your attention today, the work of an organization called One Virginia 21, Virginians for Fair Redistricting. This organization is bringing together concerned citizens from all over the Commonwealth to look at nonpartisan redistricting. Glad to have Brian Cannon with us today. He's the executive director of One Virginia 21. Thanks for being with us.
Kathy, thank you so much for having us again. Grateful for the conversation.
You're welcome. OneVirginia2021.org is where you can learn more about their efforts in this regard. It's a very, very interesting conversation. And again, we've talked about it a lot on this broadcast. So Brian, give us a sense of how this organization came to be with regard to the emphasis on nonpartisan redistricting, because a lot of our callers and a lot of experts say, wow, that's going to be really hard to do in the political environment where the party in power sort of makes the rules.
Absolutely. Well, I think in this environment that we're in now, where everybody's exhausted by the conversations that are going on, the bad. We've got to find the important things that we can all focus on that really are highlighted now, not the negative stuff, but the opportunities to fix it. And that's what folks who formed One Virginia 2021 saw 3 years ago, which was there was a bunch of people that got together from all across the political spectrum that said, these voting districts belong to Virginians. They don't belong to a party. They don't belong to a politician or a special interest. They belong to Virginians. And that's the kind of core premise of this. What we have now, though, is we have districts that we live in that are drawn for politicians by politicians, and they carve up communities, as you guys know very well in Hampton Roads. They carve up communities tremendously, and then you're left with kind of what's the voice you're representing, and I think we can do better.
So this is an interesting point, and we know that, by the way, this is a whatever party is in power does this. I mean, that's yes. that's sort of how it is, right? And so it's a process that's been underway for a long time, and certainly there have been quite a number of court cases around it and more coming down the road. David Daly is the editor-in-chief of Salon, and he is the author of a book whose subtitle is The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. David Daly, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here, Kat. Thanks for having me.
You're most welcome. So you really took a look in this book at the, and as we've said, both parties do this, but your book really focuses on Republican efforts around that because those have been sort of the most recent example of this. I wonder if you would walk through for us the impact of the drawing of those districts on voting results and what happens in terms of representation.
Sure. I think that gerrymandering goes back to 1788. You can trace it back to Patrick Henry. You can trace it back to the founding of the Republic. Both parties have done it for a long, long time. What happened in 2010 and 2011 is that the Republicans perfected it and they reinvented gerrymandering.
How so? What do you mean?
Entirely. If you're familiar with the movie Moneyball, Billy Beane, the general manager of the Oakland A's, devises a plan to compete with the big boys of baseball with a smaller budget. And that's what a handful of Republican strategists figured out in 2010. They realized that the party was facing a demographic challenge. They had lost 4 out of 5 presidential elections in the popular vote. They did not have the House. They had just come off a supermajority for Democrats in the U.S. Senate, and they realized they had to do something different. They realized that 2010 was a redistricting year because of the way the Constitution works, and we redraw all of these lines after every census in a zero year. And they realized that 2010 could be a more consequential election than even 2008, and they set about trying to flip control of congressional districts control of state legislative chambers from coast to coast in order to essentially have the only voices in the room when it came time to redistricting. This meant that they only had to flip about 110 seats, as Karl Rove put it in an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal. He wrote that if we can flip 110 state House seats, that would give us the power to redraw more than 190 congressional seats. And that's exactly what they did. 2010, remember, is a big Republican year. It's a Tea Party wave. It's an anti-Obamacare wave. Republicans win a lot of state House seats, but most importantly, they take control of legislative chambers in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, North Carolina, Wisconsin. And the next year, with the help of really sophisticated computer map-making technology, they go ahead and draw very, very difficult-to-defeat lines. And in 2012, which is the first election run on these new lines, what you see is in most of these states, a majority of votes go to the Democrats, a big majority of the seats go to the Republicans. In Pennsylvania, 100,000 more seats for Democratic candidates, but a 13-5 Democratic edge. In Michigan, 240,000 more votes for Democratic House candidates, but a 9-5 Republican edge. In Ohio, just about 50-50 Republicans kind of sneak out the 51-49, but they take the delegation 12-4, and this matters when it comes to control of the House of Representatives.
It also matters, does it not, at the state level, because you write that I think it's six state legislatures are in circumstances where people cast more votes for candidates from one of the major parties, but it's the other party that still controls the state legislature.
Yes, and that's the same thing in Michigan. It's the same thing in Ohio and in North Carolina. And in very many states, the gerrymander is not only in Congress, it affects state government as well.
This has been had a very interesting result, has it not? It's because you write about these sort of unintended consequences here, David Daley, that circumstance, that effort may actually have hurt some Republicans in the sense that it encouraged the growth of competition from the further right side of the scale.
When you have districts that are non-competitive in a general election, the only election that matters is the primary election. That pushes the party further to the right, and it sends to Washington politicians who are less interested in governing and compromise and deal-making, because those are the very things that can earn you a primary challenge. So you don't want to do any of that. And the kind of people who got sent to Washington as a result of this were a very different breed. They include Mark Meadows, a congressman from North Carolina, who takes over a district in the western part around Asheville that had been represented by a conservative Democrat. And it's Mark Meadows who files the parliamentary motion that eventually forces the resignation of John Boehner. So the kind of congressman that these districts elect, the kind of politics you get, are very, very different.
Really interesting. David Daley is the editor-in-chief of Salon, the author of The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. Brian Cannon, as you look at the work you're doing in One Virginia 21, you're really focused on this, having noted these impacts. This is very much a part of the documentary film Jerry-Rigged, Turning Democracy on Its Head, and you're really focused on looking at these implications and perhaps looking as well at some options that might respond to it.
Absolutely. And in Virginia, we have the unique distinction of actually being gerrymandered by both parties simultaneously in this decade. So the state Senate was controlled by Democrats and the state House was controlled by Republicans, and they both agreed to just gerrymander their own districts and would in exchange pass the others without objection. And so it's a very strange time that we've actually been gerrymandered by both. Usually it was forever it was Democrats. In 2001 it was Republicans for that decade, and then in this last decade it was by both. And so it's a weird mix, but it underscores the point of this is not a partisan issue. This is just an incumbent protection racket.
Yes. And as we say, whoever wins gets to do this, right? Yeah.
Yeah, whoever wins gets to do it. And it's so this kind of to the victors go the spoils thing. But what happens is you get this arms race that happens between both parties now to fight for. I mean, Dave does a great job in his book of laying out exactly how brilliant the Republican strategy was for this. Well, now the Democrats are doing the same thing. So we as citizens who maybe care less about party than the partisan operatives do, it's fine to be part of a party, but it might not be the number one identifier we all have. We got to find a way around this. And the good news is that other states have. Iowa is probably the best example, but there's some progress in Florida and Ohio, in Idaho, in California, Arizona. I mean, I think as a baseball metaphor, I think you need two things. You need an umpire or a group of umpires, right, as an independent commission, and you need some clear rules. You need a good rule book to have them agree. Otherwise, we've just got pitchers and batters arguing over balls and strikes.
Sure.
And that's just not functioning or healthy.
And we've heard so many callers to this program who have yearned for this over the years. And so I wonder, Brian, how does it look in those other states when you talk about a clear set of rules and an umpire? What are the rules and who's the umpire?
Yeah, well, so the states are our lab for democracy here. And one of the things I actually really love about Dave's book is he goes through a number of the states, some that are pushing for reform and others that have it. And I think Iowa is the best example because they've got their district lines drawn by the people, the kind of technical should be doing this. That underscores this isn't meant to be a partisan process. It can just be, look, you had some people move from the rural areas to the urban areas. You got to figure out how to adjust the lines based on equal population and go for it from there. And so Iowa does it, and they keep cities, counties, and towns together. They're not drawing it with the intent to benefit one party or another. They're just drawing these fair districts, and they've got an interesting culture out there about that I think speaks a lot to how this should be done.
You know, and it's very interesting, too, because if you look at the districts just in our listening area, those are some really crazy looking shapes. I'm not going to lie. And, you know, we sort of have this scenario where you have to drive around population centers to go to the western or the eastern part of the district. And this is not lost on voters. We're at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Those are the numbers where you can join us today. And by the way, the film Jerry-Rigged, Turning Democracy on Its Head, aired on WHRO on Sunday night, but it is also appearing in theaters near you, and a couple of opportunities are coming up locally for you to see this. One on Tuesday, November 1st in Williamsburg at the very beautiful Williamsburg Regional Library. They're going to have a reception at 6 and then move in to see the film from 6:30 to 8. So that's available for you. As well, on Wednesday, the next day, Wednesday, November 2nd, in Newport News, they will be screening the film at Christopher Newport University in the Gaines Theater there. And if you're really lucky, you know, you will run into our good friend Quentin Kidd. That's entirely possible as well. So, you know, that's a beautiful thing. So here's the question for you today. Are you in a redrawn district or a newly redrawn district, we should say? Do you even know whether your district has remained the same? 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Those are the numbers where you can join us today. David Daly, your book looks at the Republican effort around this, but as Brian Cannon noted, the Democrats are at it now, having announced a Democratic redistricting committee under the leadership of Attorney General Eric Holder. So presumably taking a page out of that playbook and trying to do it for their team.
Yeah, the Democrats got wiped out in 2010 as a result of this. It was a catastrophic strategic failure for the party, and it had ramifications that it really hemmed in the domestic agenda of President Obama in his second term. I mean, his domestic agenda essentially ended on Election Day in 2010. And they have learned from that. They are attempting to run what seems like a very similar play to what the Republicans did last time. They've put up about $75 million for it already, and they are going to be out there and ready. Trouble is, the Republicans are going to be out there waiting for them with $125 million to run a second version of the plan they did in 2010, and the Democrats still have to figure out a way to win on these maps. So they've got a really uphill battle, and I mean, my concern is a lot like Brian's, that this ends up making our politics really, really expensive, really, really nasty and negative, and that it trickles down all the way into an arms race at the state house level, and it makes it really, really hard for people to be involved in politics, and it just, you know, nationalizes every little thing that probably shouldn't be nationalized. When you can put real reform on the ballot, it tends to win in red states and blue states and purple states, you know, in Ohio and Florida and Arizona and California. Put this on the ballot and people get it. They want their elections to be fair. They want their votes to count, that they want the side with the most votes in a fair election to win. And as it is right now, we are gearing up for a big time arms race that doesn't really see any end in sight.
Stephen's on the line from Norfolk. Thanks for calling, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
The expert earlier had mentioned that there were some nonpartisan entity overseeing district creation for whether it's congressional or Senate seats. If that were constitutionally mandated, then you could have that entity oversee it, and gerrymandering could really be taken out of the picture to some extent. And that way, all of the math look nice and round and not just squigglies everywhere.
Sure.
We're trying to get all the voters in one space to kind of illuminate their power.
I hear you, Stephen. 26 minutes past the hour. Dave Daly, what does this look like? Because Steve talks about, and Brian as well, and you've noted this independent commission concept and states where they have done this. What does it look like from a ballot perspective? Is it a constitutional amendment? Is it a law change? How does it happen?
It depends on your state's process, and all of them are different. Some states don't even allow referendums. There are many examples right now. North Carolina, for example, is a case where the legislature has taken away the power of citizens to put redistricting issues even on the initiative ballot. So, I mean, politicians don't like to give up this power. They have essentially figured out how to draw their own districts and choose their own voters, and that's a very appealing thing, and it is not, you know, as you can see from the $200 million that both parties are planning to pour into this in 2020, it is not a right that they intend to give up easily. Certainly in Iowa, there is a civic culture around this, and they've got bureaucrats that make it work. In Florida, they passed two constitutional amendments mandating fair districts and nonpartisan districting, and nevertheless, partisans attempt to seep into the process and were, you know, running secret maps, funneling them through neighbors and spouses, even the Gmail addresses of former interns set up without their knowledge. So there is lots. People think about gerrymandering, and they think that this is the thing in civic class that made your eyes glaze over. It's actually very exciting. It's very important, and these lines are the building blocks of our democracy, and they, as a result, are crucial to us as citizens, but they're also crucial to politicians looking to exploit them for their own purposes.
It's a great point. And of course, what we have now, as you note, is this sort of arms race where neither side is putting the redistricting arms down in favor of something that might be better because there's so much in the current system.
There's a lot at stake.
For each side, exactly so. Pam's on the line from Yorktown. Hi, Pam, you're on the air.
Hi. 2 points. One, I honestly believe that there's no reason we can't create a computer program that would be totally impartial and only consider contiguous geography and the actual population numbers, not the makeup of the population. It would be in the case of justices blind. Wherever you happen to live, whether it be an all-minority district, a very well-mixed one, a majority district, it doesn't make any difference. That would be it. And secondly, as long as legislators make their own rules concerning their reelection campaigns, considering their benefits, the days they work, any rule that or law that is regarding legislators should not be written by legislators.
So who would write it then, Pam?
You would have to have some type of independent commission that would determine anything that affected directly that legislator or the group of them as a group. Because, let's face it, if you were in charge of your job, you'd have the highest salary, you'd have the best benefits, and you'd probably work one day a week. And doesn't our Congress do that already?
That's a very interesting point, Pam. I hear what you're saying. And, it's why on many of these issues, certainly where we have had conversations about changing things. In Virginia, we occasionally have a conversation about extending the term of the governor. Virginia, one of the very few states in the country that only has a one-term governor. And whenever that question is sort of raised for public discussion, whoever raises it says, look, this will take effect for the next governor, not for me, to your point. I thank you for the call. It's 1:30. You should know, by the way, that back in 2011, this has been going on a long time in Virginia, Governor McDonald created an independent redistricting commission. And one of the things that came out of that, and I remember because we did a show about it, was this the teams of students from 13 colleges and universities in the Commonwealth produced 57 plans. All of them, they put all of the plans online. The folks who judged them said they were extraordinarily impressed with these maps and how they respected federal and state requirements. And so they were very, very impressed with these plans. And of course, the plans are still available online. Sadly, they were not adopted, but it shows you that people are really serious about this. Brian, I don't know if you remember that process of those college students putting those together.
I do. I was in law school, and actually we had a law school team do it. One of our maps actually one of the parts of those competition. Yeah, so and that was where I got my start on this, to know that you can do this better.
Really?
Right? You kind of can't do it worse. Yeah, it was great. And the Watson Center for Public Policy out of CMU really led the way on that with the League of Women Voters and some other good folks. To Pam's point about computer programs doing this, I think she speaks to that idea speaks to, can we just get the politics out of this as much as possible. I'll say the one thing, because I've talked to a lot of people who design those programs, and of course there's some issue of the integrity of the algorithm you would use. That's fine. But getting beyond that, I think the only thing that's harder to measure by that, when you just can't draw Virginia up into these, you know, kind of quadrangles or whatever, is that you miss representing communities. And the whole point of the Constitution and the House of Representatives was that it would be communities having a voice in their government.
Mm.
And so, and Dave does a great job of talking about the folks on the far right that have replaced kind of the moderate Democrats and some of these things, and they ousted Boehner. Our organization is totally fine with folks on the far right or the far left being in there. What's the problem is that you've lost moderates, is that the moderates are almost extinct from this. And so you're not getting the full spectrum of that. And that's because communities aren't well represented. They make these Frankenstein districts where they take a little bit of Norfolk and they take a little bit of Portsmouth and then some parts of Suffolk, and they lump it all into something that is unrecognizable to anybody who lives there, but makes perfect sense for that legislator, right? And so you're drawing districts by legislators for legislators, but what would be better is if we could keep these communities together. And I have yet to see a computer algorithm that could do that. That's the pot of the gold at the end of the rainbow. If we could, I mean, I think there's a lot of people that would say that. Short of that, and that's also kind of a perfectionist argument, but there's a lot of things we can do before that. Florida's not perfect, but if we had Florida's system, it'd be better than Virginia's system, right? And there's a lot to be said for making better rules or getting some sort of umpires in there one way or another.
How would Florida's system be better? Just give us the broad strokes of that and lay that over Virginia.
Sure. So Florida passed the rule that basically said you can't politically gerrymander. You got to keep cities, counties, and towns together. And as Dave mentions really well in his book, and they got caught red-handed violating that law. The Republicans, Ben Ginsburg, he spoke at William & Mary Law School. I was there, very nice guy. He went down to Florida and they gerrymandered the bejesus out of that state, and they did it very effectively and very sneakily. But they did get caught. And the court has ordered new lines. And so there's it's not perfect. It's not Iowa. But at least there was a law on the books that made it illegal. Where in Virginia, we're looking at state districts right now and the Bethune Hill case that will be before the U.S. Supreme Court this term, where the defendants in the case said, we didn't racially gerrymander. We politically gerrymandered. We didn't do it because they were African American. We did it because they were Democrats and because we wanted to, screw over this local leader and make this person in the same district as this person. I mean, it was hyper-partisan, and that's what they admitted to. And if we could just make that illegal, too, we'd be in a better place.
Thomas is on the line from Windsor. Hi, Thomas. You're on the air.
Hi. So my question was already kind of answered,
okay.
But what I was going to ask is, I'm in Windsor, which is in Iloy County,
right.
And I think it's the district that's coming on later. I always mix up the numbers, but it's been mixed up with parts of Franklin and Suffolk and Portsmouth, and I think even Norfolk now, and pieces of Newport News. And Iloy County is very, very heavily agricultural, although a lot of people do, it's like a bedroom community for the shipyard. And so what I was wondering is, if they have the computer programs doing it, you don't necessarily get the regional interests involved. But then if you try to do it with the regional interests, what happens if you have a region that is very different than the city it's in, but it happens to be all one race or another? How do you, I don't see how a computer could necessarily balance that, because I don't see how somebody that lives on J. Clyde Morris Boulevard has the same, congressional interest as a farmer, I guess, is my question.
And Thomas, and I think that sort of gets at that idea of keeping cities together. And there are any number of cities in Virginia who are represented by multiple representatives. And so it seems pretty obvious that a city's interests might be very much the same. I thank you for the call, Thomas. I appreciate it very much. If you are interested, and you really should, because there's just a great documentary on this, and it's called Jerry Rigged, Turning Democracy on Its Head. And again, there are some local screenings coming up for you Tuesday, November 1st. That's next Tuesday. Let me rephrase that. Next Tuesday, November 1st in Williamsburg at the Williamsburg Regional Library. That's going to be at 6 o'clock, and then the presentation starts at 6:30. Then on Wednesday, the very next day, November 2nd, in Newport News at Christopher Newport University in the Gaines Theater, the reception's at 6:30, and the presentation is at 7:15. So you want to check those out. You can also log on to One Virginia 2021's website at O-N-E, that's the word one, Virginia spelled out, 2021.org, and that's where you can read more and see more about the documentary called Jerry Rigged, Turning Democracy on Its Head, and that's where you can learn more about Brian Cannon and his organization's work, and Dave Daley and his book, The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. Brian Cannon, how is this effort of being received across the Commonwealth? We know that lots of people are sort of conceptually interested in independent redistricting. So how are you doing in terms of getting people on board with the idea of at least looking at this?
Well, we've started 3 years ago from scratch. We're up to about 27,000 supporters around the Commonwealth. So we've grown a lot. And the great news is that even politicians realize this needs to be fixed. I think they realize that something's rotten in Denmark, and we got to do something about this. And so the state Senate passes redistricting reform regularly, and we've actually got enough votes in the House of Delegates to pass redistricting reform as well. We just kind of can't get it out of that subcommittee quite yet. But by the way, both chambers are controlled by Republicans, so it's not a Republican issue. Some are for it, some are against it. And we're grateful for the leadership. I think Scott Ridgel came out strongly and said, we live in a hyper gerrymandered world, and we've got to fix this. And for those who watch the documentary, you'll hear George Allen and Tim Kaine both say the same. And I think that's important to see that, to know that it's received on both ends. But I want to say, so in the book that Dave Daley wrote, he goes into the guy who actually was responsible for the strategy and the map drawing. His name is Chris Jankowski. He's a Republican strategist here in Richmond, actually. He's a very, very, very smart person. And Dave had some great conversation with him. I think the end of his book really hits on that nicely, about an ability to, the system's political, and if we could make it better, maybe we really should.
So you think, Dave, there's a sense that from a partisan perspective, that there may be a little bit of interest on this?
You know, it's really hard for me to say. Mm-hmm. I think that there is some sense that perhaps with an awareness within the Republican Party that the gerrymandering that he did on a national level as far as Congress may have overreached and may have helped sort of create a Frankenstein's monster in Donald Trump and kind of sent the party to turn the party over to the hands of its angriest base and sort of made that really uncontrollable. I mean, certainly you are reading right now that, you know, Paul Ryan is in a lot of trouble simply as far as being returned as speaker in the next Congress. So I think that, and I'd love to know the answer to this from the perspectives of some of the Republican strategists who were involved. I mean, I wonder if on some level they realized that they went a smidge too far and gave themselves control of Congress for perhaps the rest of the decade, but in the process lost control of their own caucus to a base that they probably didn't want to turn it over to.
You know, it strikes me, I've had lots of conversations with Congressman Scott Ridgel over the recent months particularly, and it strikes me that the environment that's created by what you're describing is driving a lot of good people out of Congress.
I think that's right as well. Absolutely.
Well, it's been great.
Yeah, I mean, think of it for just a...
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Kathy.
No, you.
I was going to say that, President Obama's agenda being blocked is one thing. That's partisan. You've got that, and that's always to be expected. But Congress can't even take up the issue of emergency funding for Zika, right? And that's something that's not partisan at all, and that's threatening the Southeast, and coming up, it'll probably be in Virginia next summer. And they've been trying to figure out how to do this since February. They can't get out of their own way. So not only do we have a partisan Congress that's functioning on partisan lines, that's kind of to be expected, but we've got a Congress that just can't function at all. And that's a real problem.
You know, that's an interesting point. When you have something like Zika is not just biting the mosquito is not just biting one party and not the other. That's a very significant public health problem. And that's a great example of how just gridlocked the whole thing is. The website onevirginia2021.org, that's where you can learn more. You can either learn more about these efforts, and you can read Dave Daly's book. You can get that any of the places where you ordinarily get books. It's called The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. And we'll look for this court ruling in December. That's when we anticipate a court ruling in a case brought by a Newport News woman. And there are other states. There's certainly a case in North Carolina as well. So we'll continue to keep an eye on these cases as they move through, because it is a complex issue. But at the end of it is certainly a common wish, one supposes, to bust through the gridlock in which we find ourselves. Dave Daly, thank you very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for giving all this time to a serious topic like this. Appreciate it.
You're most welcome. And again, the book is The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. Dave Daly, last name spelled D-A-L-E-Y. If you're going to be searching that out, he's on Twitter at Dave Daly 3. Brian Cannon, thanks very much for being with us from One Virginia 21. And let us know your progress.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Kathy.
You bet. Thank you so much for being with us. And One Virginia 21, I keep saying 21, that's a different organization. One Virginia 2021 is on Twitter at one, VA2021 .org. And so we'll put all that information on our Facebook page as well. But there are a lot of upcoming events that you can take advantage of Tuesday and Wednesday next week, Tuesday at Williamsburg, Wednesday in Newport News. And so we really hope you'll take advantage of those opportunities. And WHRO was very happy to air that program on Sunday night. And so I hope you enjoyed that. And we'll be back in just a moment. Minutes before the hour, and you will probably recall back in 2011, the Virginia General Assembly voted to have abortion clinics operating under the same regulations as outpatient surgical centers, and the clinics objected, saying that would need that would require them to undergo very, very costly renovations, and they questioned the implication of that and wondered what the motive was there. But there was a big meeting at the Virginia Department of Health on Monday, yesterday. And we are glad to have Saraya Wintersmith with us from WCVE, where she's a state reporter. Saraya, good to have you with us. Thank you for being here.
Kathy, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And so you were at this meeting at the Department of Health where this issue came up yesterday, correct?
I was yesterday. It was a very long 7-hour meeting.
Wow.
I was told by people there on site that it began even before 9 a.m. Originally, the board was only going to have 20 people speak during public comment. And so there were people, it's a contentious issue. So there were lots of people outside camping out, in front of the board's meeting place, making sure that they were going to be on the list. The board ended up revising the public comment period, and it went for almost 2 hours before they even got into dealing with the regulations.
Wow. What were some of the comments that you heard?
We heard yesterday from, obviously, people on the liberal side of the issue who said that the regulations that the board ultimately repealed were a guide for limiting abortion access. And we heard from people on the conservative side of the issue who say that regulations should be as strict as possible to ensure health and safety for women when they do go and decide to seek an abortion.
And so the other side of that argument proposes that that's a sort of a Trojan horse, the question of health of the woman, because the requirements for outpatient clinics have sort of been on the books a long time. And so to add to suggest that they need to be hospital grade, if you will, if you'll pardon that simplistic approach to it, would be very, very expensive and would have the effect of closing some clinics. I mean, that was really the concern, right? That the cost of renovation would close some clinics.
Kathy, that's exactly right. The health department commissioner, Dr. Marissa Levine, yesterday said that they looked at that those changes that you mentioned because of the Supreme Court's ruling in Whole Women's Health v. Hellerstedt in June. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court found, that these sorts of restrictions were a very high standard for abortion clinics to meet, and that they were unconstitutional and not necessary.
You know, this is very interesting because, as you note, the Supreme Court came down with a decision saying that. So this meeting was actually, in some respects, in response to that, to sort of figure out what Virginia's stance on this would be. And I understand that they had originally said, or originally sort of signaled, that they would lift the requirements on the 14 existing abortion clinics in the state, going along with what the Supreme Court said. But they would impose those requirements on any new clinics that were proposed. But in the end, I guess that's not, they decided not to do that either.
Kathy, I'm pretty sure that what you're saying is accurate. I don't think that I spoke to Dr. Levine, the health department commissioner, regarding what the standards will be moving forward, and I don't wish to misspeak.
Sure, of course, but at least we should note that at least, and it's affirmed that the clinics that are currently in existence will not have to meet these higher hospital style requirements. Correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, and so what was the mood like after this decision was handed down?
There were only. And that's so funny that you asked. The meeting was packed at the beginning, but by the time that marathon meeting was finished, only a handful of advocates, liberal advocates, were there, and they cheered and they celebrated when that last 11-4 vote came down on the board. And so it was celebratory, and we saw lots of press releases come out from the governor's office, from the state Democrats. But obviously, local advocates like the Family Foundation put out their press releases too, and they weren't there for the vote, but they were upset.
Saraya, it's been really nice talking with you. Thank you for being there for 7 hours yesterday. You never know when these hearings start, how long you're going to be there, and what the implications are. But so appreciate WCVE for staying on top of that, and very much appreciate your being part of the conversation today. Thanks so much.
Kathy, thank you so much.
Take care. Lois Shepherd is with us as well. She's a professor of biomedical ethics at the University of Virginia. Ms. Shepherd, thank you so much for being with us today. Very much appreciate it.
Sure. Happy to be here.
So this case that we have been talking about is really one of those many, many cases that gets at this intersection between political policy and a health care issue. What happened in Virginia with the rolling back of those requirements? Are we sort of seeing that across the country?
Well, I think we are going to see it. Although with respect to the Virginia regulations, you know, that was kind of, in a way, a proactive act that the administration did. In other words, I think we're going to see either laws struck down that are similar to laws like this. In other words, it depends upon the politics that are going on in the state, whether or not legislatures and executive branches are going to continue pursuing these kinds of laws and wait until a court actually says, no, you can't do that. This was in reaction to the Supreme Court decision, but also the politics were lined up in a way that, you know, I think this is what the current administration, you know, what they had been advocating for, you know. So it's not just that the Supreme Court decision handed down, but that, you know, the previous regulations were adopted under the previous governor, Bob McDonnell, and under the with the Attorney General Cuccinelli, and that they had a very different view than McCullough. And so the membership of the board has changed, right, of the Board of Health has changed. So this was, I think you said it well, this is kind of a combination of kind of politics and law.
And so what are some of the other issues as a biomedical ethicist that where you see this meeting in the middle of the street between healthcare and politics? I mean, we talk a lot about it around abortion, but there are other issues as well. And I wonder, with science advancing, what you see down the road when you think about these potential meeting of these two fields of study.
Well, I think we have right now what we're seeing is a lot of advocacy in behalf of physician aid in hastening death, or what's often called physician-assisted suicide. And so that's where you also see things being decided within a realm of law. In other words, the Supreme Court years ago said there wasn't a right to physician-assisted suicide, but said that states could enact legislation allowing it. And so we have a lot of variety across the board among states with respect to that. Other issues, you know, that are kind of around right now is we hear a lot about the use of ourselves when we go into hospitals and get, you know, have a sample of blood or something like that, and what kind of research uses can researchers use those cells without your consent? So I know the Henrietta Lacks book a few years ago brought a lot of attention to that. So that's something a lot of people have been concerned about. A few years ago, embryonic stem cell research was really a big issue, and state legislatures were working and trying to figure out what they wanted to do there. Cloning is another issue. So we have actually a lot of issues, you know, in bioethics and law.
Yeah. I you know, it's very interesting, too, because you look at the way the science is advancing on many of those issues that you just mentioned, many of those fields of study. And you really sort of pity the legislatures who are trying to keep up. And I wonder, from a federal perspective, what is your assessment of how well, certainly at a national level and perhaps at a state level as well, what's your assessment of how well lawmaking bodies are keeping up with the advances in science?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I mean, I think certainly they have. It's often talked about that the law is behind where the science is, and certainly that's a challenge. But I think the bigger challenge is that some of these things become politicized, and so things that are actually well known as a scientific matter get misconstrued, you know, or twisted in the way of some of the political rhetoric. So I think actually, you know, legislatures and executive branches are perfectly capable of getting up to speed, you know, with respect to these things and making the best decisions that could be made. You know, there's always uncertainty about the future. But a lot of what happens is instead that politics get involved. So, for example, these regulations, you know, for they're part and parcel of something that's been going on in our country for the last 10 or so years, you know, special provisions for abortion clinics that didn't have, many of them did not have a scientific basis or a factual basis. So I think that's one of the things that Supreme Court decision recently was talking about, the whole woman's health decision,
yeah.
is that we're gonna look at the evidence. We're not just gonna defer to legislatures, not because they're not capable, right? But that we can't, when people's rights are at stake, we can't just defer to state legislatures with respect to whatever they think the health justification is for something. That courts should be willing to scrutinize those.
You know,
so that's what's getting ready to happen. I think we have laws across the country relating to
right.
abortion that you know they've had a free pass in a way for a number of years, and now I think there's going to be a check on them to see if are they really promoting women's health. A lot of them are justified on those grounds, but. Are they really promoting women's health, or are they just an obstacle to an abortion?
So another related law that was pitched as a way to protect women's health was Senate Bill 53 and bills like it. This Senate Bill 53 in Virginia, which required pregnant women to have ultrasounds. This was passed back in 2012. There have been repeated attempts to repeal that. State Senator Mamie Locke tried it again to get it repealed in January, and the initiative was her effort was voted down in a committee. And, you know, I wonder, as you look at that particular bill and bills like it, do you sense that given this Supreme Court ruling that some of those rules will also come into question and review?
Absolutely. I mean, they are already being challenged. They just have, you know, at lower district court level, and they haven't just made their way kind of, you know, up the appellate chain. But yes, ultrasound laws, some of the waiting periods, you know, how long you have to wait. So originally, the whole woman's health decision is the most major case, I guess, in about 25 years since a 1992 case called Casey, which said you could have a waiting period, which said the state can have an interest in protecting potential life and ensuring that the woman's decision is informed. And part of what was upheld in that 1992 case was a waiting period. But they've gone from 24 hours in some cases now to 48 or 72. And when you're talking about abortion clinics being fewer and far between, that can mean a long delay. Like a woman has to have two visits, two, you know, times taking off work. And the abortion can then, because of these regulations, actually ends up occurring later in the pregnancy
and
with
so,
a higher risk.
And so we will continue to keep an eye on the courts to see where that goes. Lois Shepherd, thanks for being with us today, professor of biomedical ethics at the University of Virginia. Very much appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
Up next here on 89.5, it is the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Then coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 8 o'clock, it's The Contenders. It's a show about the race involving Geraldine Ferraro and Sarah Palin, the Trailblazers. And at 9 o'clock, really, really neat show about Norman Lear. He's on American Masters tonight. And the show looks at the way that Norman Lear really affected social change through so many of his sitcoms, most especially All in the Family. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with candidates who want to represent those of you who live in the 4th Congressional District. That continues our candidate conversations. We'll see you then.